You are listening to the Improv Save My Life podcast, brought to you on Bits, the Boston Improv Talk Station.
All right, welcome to episode 79 of the Improv Save My Life podcast. I'm your host, Tom Boyer. This podcast is brought to you on Bits, the Boston Improv Talk Station. The guest this week is Pam Victor. Hey, Pam.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm fantastic.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Pam has a lot of projects. She's currently the co-author of Improvisation at the Speed of Life, the TJ and Dave book. She's also the producer of the Happier Valley Comedy Show in Western Mass. She writes and performs Geeking Out With, and she also teaches and writes the curriculum of Zen Improv. And you can find all this information out at pamvictor.com. How's it going, Pam?
Fantastic. I'm having such a good day.
Great. You were coming from doing an interview of your own, correct?
Yeah, I interview people also. It's fun to be on both sides of the of the microphone, so to speak. Yeah, I was just interviewing Kate Flannery from The Office.
She played
at the Women Comedy Festival. She played Meredith. It was really interesting. Interview. I think they're going to hopefully put it up there because she shared some helpful stuff.
Nice. Yeah, I thought she was an interesting character on that show. She kind of started off almost as like a background character with a couple, you know, lines here and there, but then they just made her more and more over the top by the end.
She talked about that. She talked about, like, do you complain when you only get a couple lines? And she's like, no, I'm just happy to be working. And then they wrote it more and more.
Nice. So where are you from originally?
I grew up in, near Detroit, Michigan. That's where I grew up and then lived there for a while. And then I moved around. I went to a different school. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
The very first beginning. And then I went to a different school every year from seventh grade on in different cities, different states, and a couple different countries.
Were you in a military family?
No, everybody asked that. And no, my mother is just kind of a nomad. So we moved around a lot. We were in California in a few places, and then I was an exchange student in France. I was at a boarding school in California and then ended up in Michigan.
Do you think moving a lot and having to make new friends all the time kind of influenced your sense of humor?
I wonder if it, I don't know if it influenced my sense of humor, but certainly that aspect of me in that, well, the one thing that I learned, and this is like when I was middle school and high school, so it's been not easy times to be the new kid, first certainly, and I learned that context was everything, and that in some schools, I was one of the coolest kids, and in other schools, the next year, I was the biggest dork. Like, I was the uncool kid.
Right.
And it was just like me, I had a friend, like me and two Mormons, you know, it was just, I had no friends at all. So I learned that it's not me. It's just the context.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's even, like, geographically where you are, what is cool is different.
Absolutely. And I went to, like, completely different schools. One in Michigan was this small, very taken care of school for almost gifted kids. Not almost gifted. They were, instead of gifted kids, I'm not gifted, but... and then I was at a school in San Diego for the kind of public school, but there are a lot of army brats there. And then I was at an inner city school in the mountains of Palm Springs, where it's like teen pregnancy and drugs and stuff.
Do you think you benefited from having all these different experiences? I think even improv wise, you would have picked up, you know, a lot of life experience that you could use.
Yeah, I became worldly by the age of 16, 17. I had lived, you know, in France for a year. I'd been living on my own, actually, for quite a long time by that time. So I was very independent. I guess maybe it helped me establish some confidence and that I can just go out there and I can make pretty much anything work.
Cool. So how did you find yourself getting into comedy?
And I differentiate between, I consider myself an improviser more than a comedian.
You know, I was going to say improviser, but sometimes when I interview people, they do other projects,
it's
so
true.
They don't like to be pigeonholed.
It's true, yeah, because I'm a writer also, and I'm a teacher, I'm a lot of other things. But for me, my love is improvisation. and the way I have been taught to do it, you know, most recently by TJ and Dave in the course of writing the book, is to go for to focus on the improvisation first, and the comedy sort of as a side effect. So I'll say, well, yeah, right. So there's a two-part answer. But the comedy, I remember, like, actually around the same year, seventh grade at that school for gifted kids, I remember it was the same year that my parents were having a really horrible, hideous custody battle. So I'd be taken to shrinks all the time because they wanted me to testify against the other parent. It was lovely. I remember this so specifically. I was at the shrinks, and we were playing some feelings board game or something like that. And I think the card said, "What was the best thing that happened to you today?" And I remember saying, "I made Stephanie Schneider laugh, and that felt good." And like, it was just this, I'll never forget that moment. It's like, it felt good to make somebody else feeling so good that this impulsive sound came out of their face. This sound of joy came out of their face without them even wanting to.
I remember I was at a shrink's office when I was maybe 12 or something, which I didn't really, it wasn't for me. It was like circumstances. And, I remember she was asking what I did that day or that week or something, and I was like, I went to see Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which is a terrible sequel to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. But like, she had no concept of the words that were coming out of my mouth. Like, it just sounded like the most obscure thing, because I don't think she'd heard of the movie, and like, the title is just bizarre. And even as a kid, like, seeing her try to relate to me, and like, oh yeah, what's it about? And then I was explaining this preposterous story. Like,
had to be there.
Yeah. So it's weird, those things that you remember.
Right. It is. It is true. Absolutely. And I improvised that year also at the school in seventh grade. That they had us, we played the Newlywed Game all the time. We had a 12th grader was our theater teacher, because they have to do service, you know, at the school, and she was teaching. And I remember, like, oh, that improv thing, that's fun.
Did they call it improv?
I think they did. I think it was theatrical improv. But we were playing the Newlywed Game, which is like a short form. Maybe she was doing some Viola Spolin stuff. I don't know. I just found her again on Facebook, that woman. She's grown up. Funny. It's weird how that happened. And then I didn't improvise for a very long time after that.
Was it something in the back of your mind?
I didn't even No, like, this is in the 80s and 90s. Like, nobody was doing it outside of Chicago, and then right. In the 90s, New York, and L.A., I guess, the Groundlings. But I guess Whose Line Is It Anyway came on, and I thought it was funny. But then I was being a mom. I was a stay-at-home mom for my kid's whole life. And my son is 18, or 19, I guess, and my daughter's 16. Now. And so when my daughter got to be 3 years old, I saw a sign at the Big Y supermarket that said improv classes. I was like, oh, that would be a good way to get out of the house.
That's awesome.
And I just fell in love. I just fell in love immediately.
So you started by taking classes again at the Y, at the local Y.
Well, no, it was at the Big Y, which is the supermarket. But it was like, yeah, we had an improv troupe, and I guess I went to see them. I don't really remember. I mean, I loved it, of course. It was amazing. But it wasn't until I got into the class and I could do it. It was something I could do that felt good to do.
Was it tough trying to find time to take classes and perform with young children?
Yeah, and I live in Western Massachusetts, so there really wasn't a scene. So it was like, this was the class. So, and then that class finished, and I made the class sign up for another session, and I got the teachers, and then I got the teachers to teach a master class, and then they were the only game in town, and they didn't cast me in their show because, you know, I'd had 12 weeks of improvisation in my life. So I booked a gig and needed to get a troupe together in order.
You created your own show?
I did. I went to the class, and I was like, I literally booked a gig. I didn't have a group. I was just at my library, and I was like, yeah, I feel like we could do a show. It's been fun in class. We're pretty good.
Yeah.
And so then I got a group together. To perform that show. And 12 years later, we're still performing, almost 13 years later.
The same people?
There are three of us that are the same, and that's out of five.
That's awesome.
And then the other two have been with us for many years also. It's incredible. 5 or 6 years. Yeah, it's really great.
I'm love them. Part of two groups, and like, I don't know how they groups stay together. Like,
it's really hard. You have to not, like, we're really picky about bringing people in at this point, and it's all about sane. Like, I won't work with people who are dicks. I won't work with people who are crazy. In my group, I'll work with them on stage for sure, but I just don't want them in my own team because I want to. It's a family.
I've been coming to that. I literally came to that realization pretty recently. It's like, listen, only sign up for projects that you're excited for. Don't do stuff just for the grind of it, just to get experience. Like, experience is good, but you can get shows, and to do it with the people you want to do it with is what I've been finding. It makes it, you don't have that sense of dread, you know, like, oh God, I have to do this show. You know, you look forward to doing these shows.
Absolutely. And it's really, I mean, we're now the only game in town, and it's not like I can go on another team if these guys don't work out. If we have a fight or something like that, we have to all get along.
Nice.
And we do, and we're lucky that we do. So yes, it was hard doing it with kids. And it was many years before I couldn't take, like, there were no more classes because it was just like a one-time class thing, basically. Improv Boston is 2 hours away from me, so that's not feasible as a mom who's home. But I was really intense about it. It was my passion. It was one of those moments. It's like, you know, it's like, this is what I need to be doing right now. And this was such an interest in reading about it and watching it. I went down to the Del Close Marathon and sat through 20 hours of improvisation in a weekend. I still, all these years later, have this pretty much almost bottomless enjoyment of improvisation. I'm a little pickier about what I watch. But read and stuff like that. But I love it so deeply. But it took, my dream was to go to IO, to go to their summer intensive for 5 weeks. And it took me, it was probably 5 or 6 or 7 years of waiting until my kids were old enough for me to go.
Wow. Now your kids are older.
Yeah.
Are they interested in improv? Do they come see you perform?
Yep, they do. So I homeschooled my son for 10 years, which was another thing that, you know, I needed to be home for, and my daughter for 5 years. And my son just went to college, so that my homeschooling job just ended a year ago. So I taught classes, and one of the classes that I taught for homeschoolers was improv. So they have been watching and taking improv since they were very little. Like, my daughter was in preschool, her first improv show that she saw.
That's awesome.
So now they're both actors. They both love acting a lot. They both do. They've done tons more Shakespeare than I've done. My son just did a show in college. My daughter's constantly doing shows at high school, and she's in an improv troupe. She doesn't want me to have anything to do with it. They just get together and dick around, I think, mostly.
Nice. Yeah, I can't say enough. For getting into improv early and taking it in school. I don't think my high school had an improv program, and I was not into theater at all. Like, it kind of scared me, and I don't know, I was put off by the whole theater scene. I'm a shy person by nature, so none of that really appealed to me. I really didn't find, you know, I knew of Who's Line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was younger, but I never—I didn't really know improv was something that was had sections in different cities, and you could get into if you really wanted to. I've been interviewing a lot of people, and more people saying, "Oh, I started in high school," and I think that's great. We're going to see a big boom of more and more improvisers showing up.
T.J. Jagodowski, when we were writing the book, we talked about this. It's not in the book, but so I feel a little bit conflicted about improv in high school, just based on something T.J. said to me, which is, he's like, because he feels a little bit conflicted about it, that he'll see people get out into Chicago and they're 22 years old and they're like, they've done improv for 8 years, right, at high school and college, and they think they know everything there is to know about improv. And the truth is, you really don't get good, I think, until you get older, like past 25, because you have to have actual life experience. You have to be shit on a little bit to be a good improviser.
Yeah.
Something hard, you know, to survive it.
I agree. Like, not citing specific examples, but, like, there are people that I've interviewed that are young that have been doing it for, you know, 8 years or something like that, and they're good, but they're not 8 years ahead of everybody else that's doing it, you know, at this time.
It's just a different level. It's a different depth, I think.
Yeah.
So when I think, do it as long as you respect the art and that it has different depth, that you don't, you never know everything there is to know about improvisation, ever, yeah. ever.
Exactly. It's on the fly.
It is, and that's why I know so many people who've been doing it for decades and decades and still are completely enthralled by it, because it's something that you never achieve.
So what was your next step after starting to perform shows in the Western Mass? I was going to say the Midwest for a second. How did you evolve from there?
Slowly. See, the biggest thing for me, I mean, it was frustrating. And the funny thing is that everything I thought was my albatross, doing improvisation in an area that at the time there were literally five improvisers for most of the time, like literally five professional improvisers that I could count on. And they hadn't gone through IO. They hadn't gone to IB. You know, I didn't know anybody else that was feeling the same drive that I was feeling. And I thought that was my weakness. Like this is holding me down. But actually that was my gift, because it led me to so many things that I never would have done. So I've never been cast on a team. I've never gone through an entire program, curriculum. My first curriculum I'm going through is the one I'm developing and teaching.
Wow.
And every team I've been on have been ones that I've created. I guess there's one now that I'm doing down in West Springfield that I guess I was cast in that one. But that wasn't until like 2 years ago. I had to make every opportunity. So if I wanted to be in a show, I had to produce a show.
Yeah.
If I wanted to study with Will Luera, who was the artistic director of Improv Boston, you know, when I was in my intense study phase, I had to get a way to bring him out. So part of my show was that I would get Improv Boston to come do one set. So I'd get Will to come bring people out, and they would do a set, so we got to see more improv, and then he would teach a workshop. Then I got connected with somebody, Piero Procaccini, who's a Second City teacher, and he works at Second City Tour, BizCo, and he has family in Northampton, near where I live. And so every time he'd come out, I'd be like, would you teach a workshop for us? So I've had to cobble together. So slowly, I cobbled together an education and opportunities. And then I think the thing that took it to the next level, but I never stopped. You know, and there were times that I would be, I remember talking to Elise Sherman, who's she's at Improv Boston, but she's one of the founders of the Women in Comedy Festival, and sort of bemoaning the fact. It's like, I want someone just to put me on a team and I don't have to think or organize or rent the space. I just want to perform. She's like, you have to make your own opportunities, Pam. It's like, I don't wanna. Okay. You know, I felt bad for like a day. And then the next day I'm like, okay, what's my next opportunity? So one day I was coming out to do a Joe Bill workshop at Improv Boston, and just found him to be absolutely, have you studied with Joe?
No.
He's from Bassprov, and he's an Improv Olympic person, or IO person, and he is one of the founders of Annoyance Theater in Chicago. And he's a fascinating, he's a very, very smart man, and the way he thinks about improvisation is, yeah, it opens up worlds for you. And I was like, all I want to do is sit down in a bar with Joe and geek out about improvisation for like 3 hours. So that's how my geeking out with interview series was devised, so I could figure out a way where I could sit down with him, me in Western Massachusetts, him in Chicago. And I just like slowly got a few interviews under my belt until then I asked him to do it. And then once he did it, I could get Susan Messing and Mark Sutton and Sharna, and like, they just started coming and coming. So I think that helped get me a lot to where I was. And then from that, the Women in Comedy Festival a few years ago, I can't, I was just talking to Elise about this today. I don't remember, like, if it, maybe I approached them, and because I put a lot of lines in the water. So I'm constantly.
I do too.
Yeah, and if you put too many, a lot in the water, it's great because you forget about them.
Yep.
So when something gets, you get a bite, you're like, oh, great. You're just pleasantly surprised. You're not, you don't have, oh, this is my only thing. You know, I hope this works out. So I constantly, just like I booked the gig before I had the troupe, I'm constantly putting stuff out there that I don't know that I can do. So I probably asked Elise, well, I could interview people live if you ever wanted someone to do that, because the panels at Women in Comedy Festival are amazing. And then I found myself sitting down for the first time for a live interview that I've ever done in my life with Rachel Dratch of Saturday Night Live. And I didn't know what to do, and just worked really hard and researched the hell out of it and just asked her questions.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and it just one led to another, so I've done a lot of those.
Was that a couple of years ago when she
was
here?
That was a few years ago, yeah. I think that was, because, yeah, it was her, yeah, I guess it was 3 years ago, and then the next Women in Comedy Festival, I interviewed Stephanie Lang from HBO. She's a producer of HBO, and then this one. And then I've done them in Chicago and Detroit as well.
I find interviewing people is a very positive experience. You, by sitting down and talking to somebody for 45 minutes to like an hour, you kind of get to know that person. And if you see them around, you know, you're going to talk to them.
Yep.
You know, if they have projects, they think of you.
Yep.
It's very beneficial.
Absolutely. I mean, it got me to the point by the time I went to take a class in Chicago, some people knew me. You know, so that's kind of where Sharna could be like, oh, hey, Pam, that's amazing that I got to be at that point. And then, you know, you be nice. It's the same rule. Don't be a dick. Be really nice. I never try to catch people up and make them feel, you know, I might ask a couple hard questions, but not to make them look bad, but just to really understand what's going on with them.
Yeah, I agree. You said you try stuff sometimes without knowing if you're going to be able to do it or not.
All the time, yeah.
Have you had times when you have kind of struck out?
Gosh, I don't know. I'm sure I have. Maybe I'm really good at remembering only the good stuff. But the thing is, and this is all the Zen of Improv stuff, is that even the times you strike out often lead to other things. You're like, oh, well, that just wasn't the path. And so then you... that gives you more energy into something else. So I don't even know that there's ever a strikeout unless you stop trying.
Yeah, makes sense.
There are people who have certainly said no to me a lot.
Yeah.
There's a team I want to be on very desperately in Boston. I want to be on Big Bang really badly. And I talked to Will Luer about it. And just last night I did another. And now it's become almost a joke where it's like, yeah, that's never going to happen, Pam.
You performed last night, correct?
I did, with Fourth Wall. I did a show where the audience plays the main character of the show.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, we made that once. Me, Sasha Goldberg, and Laurie Strauss created that format. And we did the show last night with Paul Dome. I did the show with Paul Dome, Mosey McNally, and Mish Whitaker. So anytime you get those people on stage, you can't go wrong.
Nice. How did you go about creating a curriculum for...
Yeah, another thing where it's just like, huh?
How many levels is it?
Well, every one's the next one. So I think I'm up to... I don't do levels that way, but I guess I have four levels, I could say, at this point. Plus an applied improvisation. Mindfulness through laughter is my applied improvisation program. I never enjoyed teaching improvisation, to tell you the truth, before I started writing Improvisation at the Speed of Life with TJ and Dave, because it's just like, it felt like the thing that was for me. And I, even though I'm a teacher, I have my master's in education, I've always been a teacher for little kids, but I felt like improv was for me, and it didn't feel great to teach people pan right, pan left.
Right.
And it just didn't do anything. But once I learned TJ and Dave's approach, it started to, I was like, okay, this is something I can teach. And it's a natural approach where you're just taking the next little step and making an honest move in the moment. You're not playing a game or anything artificial like that, or telling jokes. So those scenes where people are just sitting down and being real are very fun to watch with. From day one, they're fun to watch. Because that was the other thing. Like, sometimes I didn't like teaching because I'd have to sit through a lot of shitty improv. It sounds awful, but
no,
it's just me. I was like, look, I'm not getting paid to, all, you know, you always know I was getting paid for it. So, but now I never sit through any shitty improv. It's from day one, they're performing, they're interesting people talking about their lives, which is interesting.
I read a little bit about that in the book. I think it was Dave said maybe he learned it from Del Close, but I might be mistaken here, that they said just play it honest.
Yep.
And people won't judge you because they think you're playing a character. So just be as honest as you can, and that's what people relate to.
Yeah, and Del said they'll never see that coming. Yeah, that's the Del Close. Del was almost his only teacher. Certainly his main teacher.
And I found myself in scenes kind of doing that, playing, speaking as myself in a character. And I'm like, well, I don't know if this is going to go over well, but it does, because you're acting like yourself. You know, you're speaking in your own voice.
So you look like a really good actor.
Yeah.
Because they don't know you're just being you.
Yeah. And, I found it to be very helpful.
It is. And we think our stories are boring because we have to live in our heads all the time. But you've had so many interesting experiences in your life. And even though if I haven't had the same experience, I can relate to you. And I think authenticity is another really powerful and attractive thing on stage. We like watching people be authentic.
Right.
And that just makes us happy. So just be you. And I'm not saying you never will play another kind of character than, you know, whatever person you are at that point. I could be me being a dad, or I can be me being a homeless person or whatever. I play myself pretty well.
How did writing the book come about?
Same story. I'd never done anything like that. And I asked. I did a Geeking Out With interview with David and then TJ in Chicago when I was at IO for the summer intensive. And I wrote them a note and I said, I'm not done being in your heads. I've interviewed a lot of people and you approach it differently. And I think there's a book there. And if I just read it, I'd be so happy just to be a reader. But if I could help you bring it to a book form, it would be a huge honor.
So this book, at least this particular book, would never have come about without you.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they say, the guys both will say that. They had written stuff previously, but I think it hadn't gotten anywhere. And I'm pretty pushy. So I learned the last 10% is the most important part of the job. So you keep plugging away. It took us 2 years to write the book, from the first meeting to the book.
What was the process? Did you sit down and interview them and then transcribe it and then put your notes in? Because it's kind of a different format than a lot of books you'll see, where you're kind of interjecting and giving, like, prefaces and stuff like that.
Yes, it's born of interviews. We went through a lot of different ways that we did it because we were trying to figure out how to do it. They were in Chicago and I was in Western Massachusetts. We only met to work in person, I think twice, once in New York, once in Chicago, and neither of those times are particularly productive. So almost all of it, they said they would let me write a book with them. They said yes. And then weeks went by without anything happening. And then they wouldn't answer any of my emails. So I wrote a table of contents, which looks very similar to that table of contents. And it was basically, I wrote the book I wanted to read. Everything I wanted to hear TJ and Dave talk about, because as I needed as an improv student, what I needed to learn. If you do it for yourself, it's always, at least it will, the book will help one person. I knew that for sure. So once I wrote the table of contents, I think that was the next, was able to get us to the next step. So we sat, oftentimes, I would say most of it was, we would be on the phone, and I gave them the questions beforehand, and then I'd ask them the questions, and they would tell me the answers to them. We'd talk about it a lot, and some of those are not transcripts, but highly edited transcripts that are in the book. And then I would take that and make it into a chapter.
Awesome.
Yeah, so it's it was transcribing and a lot of organizing stuff. It was a lot longer.
How do you feel about the product that came out? Like, what it had to go through an editor and all that. Did it change a lot?
Some of it did. Some of it did. I had a lot of hands-on for, I'd say, 3/4, maybe even more, 80% of the process. And then when we decided to self-publish, TJ and Dave kind of took it from there, and they gave it to editors, and I was not part of the editing process so much. So it got changed quite a bit. So in some ways, I'd say, some of it. I'd say from the listening chapter on, I don't know, there's some things. I was like, oh, a joke was cut. You know, I can see everything that's not there. But my goal was to write a book that TJ and David would be proud of. That was really, really important to me. And they are proud of this book. At least they told me they were proud of the book. So I'm happy with that.
That's awesome. I just got it recently, so I'm only about halfway through it. But I've really enjoyed what I've read so far.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you're liking it. It's terrifying to let a book out into the world. It's really, really hard.
Pardon me.
You think, you know, there's that period when you've written it and nobody else has seen it, and it's perfect because, you know, nobody's seen it. And then you have to let it, you know, so giving it to editors was terrifying because they cut, like, so much great stuff that I thought was great. And then letting it out into the world where it's going to be interpreted and judged is hard. It's very personal.
Would you consider writing another book?
Yeah, I'm working on another book. This is a lot of times when we'd be writing, I was saying, oh, but this stuff is all about life, you know, and it's very Buddhist. And TJ doesn't want anything to do with any of that kind of thinking or writing. And Dave, I think we're more seeing improvisation in that way, in a more spiritual way, but not. They're like, this is not that book. Put it in your own book. So I would put it in my own book. So right now I am working on The Zen of Improv, which is on my blog, My Nephew is a Poodle. And so that is, I think, is going to be the basis of my next book.
So The Zen of Improv, does it deal with spirituality?
Yeah, it deals with learning life lessons or practicing life lessons through improvisation. So the blog is written for improvisers, but the book will be written for normal people. because I have some people, like my cousin is reading it. She's not an improviser. She's only seen like 2 improv shows in her life. But it's all about failing, you know, failing with grace or redefining failure or a lot of non-judgment stuff on how you're not supposed to judge yourself.
It's tough.
Yeah. It is tough, but it's important to do. I mean, that's what my curriculum is all about. Non-judgment is a huge part of Zen of Improv 1. If you establish a situation where we're all on the same team and we're serving the show, we're serving the moment first and foremost. We're not trying to make ourselves look funny. We're trying to make the moment the best moment it can be. And once we start judging it, when we start listening to what I call the evil mind meanies, which are the people that are in your head, the voices in your head that conjugate to suck, right? I suck, you suck, they suck, this sucks. And that voice I've named Kevin in my head because I think it's fun to give them a real name. I have Kevin and I have Brittany. So you say, shut up, Kevin. That's sort of a mantra in in my classes. We say, shut up, Kevin. Because when you get into the judgment head, you're not in the moment that's happening on stage. And so you're not improvising.
Yeah, I found myself after like a montage and after a scene maybe doesn't go well, you'd be on the sideline or the back line, and instead of paying attention to what's going on and trying to add, you're like, God damn it, why did I do this or why did I do that or what was that person thinking, you know, instead of just being in the moment.
And you're not even judging it well, because you don't know what that thing that you think went wrong, how that's going to play out. Because if your scene partners are doing their job, they're making you look brilliant, right? Because that's our job, is to make each other. So anything that I would see that didn't work, or we don't know what it is yet,
right,
we can take it and make it into something that works. So often with something that looks like a mistake in the first set or the first scene can end up like making the show that one of the best things in the world. So you really, you do yourself a disservice by judging it, because you're not judging it accurately. So I have this thing that I'm thinking about and writing about a bit, is does good and bad improv exist in rehearsal and in the classroom? Because if you're learning, and even on stage, we're still learning all the time. I've learned more from bad shows than I have from good shows.
Yeah.
So if you're learning, you're becoming better, and that's good. And if you're doing the perfect scene, then you're not learning and you're not growing as an individual. So that's kind of bad. So I don't even think good and bad are useful terms to be using with your work.
That's a good point. For somebody that like me that is interested in this and struggles with self-judgment often, how would I go about... Could you learn your curriculum remotely?
Well, I mean, you could read The Zen of Improv, which maybe might be helpful. No, you can't. I mean, you have to come to a class, or hopefully people will bring me to festivals so I can spread the word. And most of my students are not improvisers. They're people who are using improvisation to make themselves feel more fulfilled and more developed as people. But I say, like, starting tomorrow, there are a couple things that you can do. Is you can use curiosity, I think, is really important. And instead of, you can't make yourself not judge, right? I totally judge. But you can ask yourself, I wonder what it feel like not to be judging this moment right now. So it's a non-doing. It's not a forceful thing, because it's like trying not to think of an elephant, right? All you're thinking about is no. Try not to think about no judgment. All you're doing is judging. So I wonder what it would be like not to judge. And then you listen harder to the moment that's happening right then. And another thing that I use a lot is Tina Fey said, confidence is 90% delusion, 10% talent. So you have to get on stage every time and delude yourself into thinking you're amazing. And until you get off stage and you can decide otherwise, what you can learn from it. So, and I would also say, like, go ahead and beat yourself up for a little while. I also think don't beat yourself up for any longer than the scene was.
Right.
So if it was a 2-minute scene that just fucking sucks shit, go feel super bad for 2 minutes, because those feelings exist. You can't make that go away. It exists. It's real, and it didn't feel good. So wallow in it, you know, and even take 24 hours if you really... I won't wallow in for 24 hours, but if I have a bad show, I will let myself feel... You know, I won't try to feel better for 24 hours. I'll be like, that sucked, and I feel sucky for that amount of time. And then what can we learn from it? 24 hours later, I'm saying, okay, it's only bad if I don't learn from it. So what can I... I mean, I just had a string of, like, really mediocre shows, and I came out like, okay, still learning. What could I learn from it? And I had a great show last night, because I was going into it thinking, what I learned is I need to have more fun. Susan Messing says, yeah, you want to have more fun than anyone on that stage. If you're not having fun, you're the asshole. That's what Susan says. So all I wanted to do is, I said to the guys backstage, I was like, I want you to fuck with me or fuck me on stage. Either one is fine with me. Let's just have like the most fun ever. And it was felt great. Felt great.
Nice. So you... as somebody that's new into improv,
only 12 years, yeah.
Somebody that's new into improv.
I'm too, yeah.
I would consider you to be someone quite successful and accomplished.
Oh.
Where do you still, like, what goals do you still have?
To be a better improviser. Same goal that anybody has.
Do you think that ever goes away?
No, I know it doesn't.
Yeah.
Because David Pasquese still has the same exact goal. TJ Jagodowski. I mean, those to me are the two best improvisers in the world, in my opinion. And they are still nervous before shows, and they still are seeking the best show ever. I mean, yeah, it's funny. TJ was just started chatting with me a little bit a couple of weeks ago, and he's like, yeah, we're kind of on a, you know, things are just, for them, it's brilliant. I like, their is my, the best show ever.
Right.
So I'm just trying to be the best improviser I can be. I'm trying to be the best teacher I can be. I'm trying to, yeah, get to do it with more different people, because I'm never going to be really good at all the kinds of improv. Like, I can do my thing okay, like a grounded, not super fast stuff. I'm never going to be great at the UCB approach, what they wrote out in their manual. That's just not my strength. But I want to be good enough at that that I can jump into a set with people who are playing in that style and not humiliate myself. So I want to be able to play with everybody. And I want to be able to let them have a great ride, a great joy ride also. So if I jump into I'm not great at musical improv, but I do some musical improv. I just want to get in there and have fun and make my scene partners have a lot of fun.
So it's like almost always evolving.
That's the Buddhist thing about it. You're never going to achieve it, you know? I think there's some Buddhist saying, like, before enlightenment, haul water. I'm probably saying it wrong because I always say things wrong, quotes wrong. That's why I can improvise, because I can't memorize the script. Before enlightenment, haul water. After enlightenment, haul water.
It's not done.
There's no done until you just walk off. Until it doesn't feel good anymore.
Do you foresee a time when you won't be doing improv?
I hope not. I love it so deeply. I have friends that are taking breaks and hiatuses and stuff like that. And Susan Messing says, you know, sometimes you just need to get off stage and make a real cup of coffee. That's my good. Susan Messing. Yeah, right. You're not miming it. I don't know. I mean, I hope if that is a, I hope it's a decision I get to make myself if that ever happens. It's my life. I love it. I love it so deeply. Thank God my husband is really understanding about it. My kids, like, they put it, it's equal in importance to them as it is to me in some ways, because they know if mom ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. So they know it makes me feel good, and so then I can do my job for them a little better. Can't imagine it. I can't imagine it.
Awesome. Are there any other topics you want to talk about, or like advice you'd want to leave us with?
Oh, I gave you all my good stuff right away. I don't know. Have more fun. I really feel like those are the two things, is like to listen. You can always listen better. And I learned to understand in writing this book that listening is more than what we do with our ears. And in a scene, you're listening with your eyes, right? You're getting the eye contact and the body language stuff. You're also listening with sort of your third eye to that sense, that vibe that's going on in the room, and the audience is sort of part of that too. You're listening with your heart, how you feel about what's going on, and you're listening with your gut. And of all of those, your heart and your gut are the ones that can never, ever be wrong. So they're almost the ones you can trust the most. So if you have a gut feeling that you're doing a scene with the guy you're doing a scene with, that he, you know, your boyfriend and girlfriend or whatever, and he cheated on you, that is correct. Whether it plays out that he ever cheated on you, no, he cheated on you. You just didn't find out about it over the course of the scene. Right. So trust your gut. So listen, pay attention better, and find what's fun to you, and find people who that is also fun for, and do it a lot. Do it a lot.
Okay. That's great advice.
Thank you.
So check out Improvisation at the Speed of Life.
It's the British way of saying it. Improvisation. I'm Italian.
I say this word all the time, but for some reason when I'm saying the book title, it doesn't come out well. Improvisation at the Speed of Life, the TJ and Dave book, co-authored by Pam Victor. Also check out PamVictor.com, where you can find out about Zen of Improv. Also check out Geeking Out With, and check out the Happier Valley Comedy Show.
Yeah, if you're ever in Western Mass, come on out. Tell me you heard about it through this podcast.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Pam.
Thank you so much. That was a pleasure.
And thanks for listening. Bye.